case, Barry versus Employers Mutual Casualty Company, 98-2557. Mr. Tarnoff, representing Mr. Barry, will proceed.
Thank you. I'm Michael Tarnoff from Warshawski Law Firm in Milwaukee. I represent the plaintiff appellant, cross-respondent petitioner Fred Barry in this Safe Place case action, which involves, I believe, several crucial issues that determine the meaning and definition of the Safe Place statute duties. As this court knows, however, the Court of Appeals only dealt in any significant way with the question of what's the definition of a structural defect under the Safe Place statute. We have argued that there's some question based on Mr. Boyle's book, which is relied on and has been cited in many Safe Place cases, as the court knows, a question as to whether that should continue to be the main source of definition of these duties, or if this court should redefine and expand on that definition. However, our position is that whether this court fashions any new definition or continues to rely on Mr. Boyle, that the defect in this case was a structural defect and that the Court of Appeals was erroneous in reversing the trial court who ruled that it was a structural defect. The Court of Appeals' main reason in reversing the trial court was that the structural defect can only arise as a result of the original construction of the building. But neither Mr. Boyle in his book nor any Wisconsin case says that. They cite examples of structural defect from Mr. Boyle's book and state that all these conditions relate to the original stairway structure, location, and safety codes. Again, there's no case that says that. Mr. Boyle's very first example, when he gives an example of, he gives many examples of structural defects, his very first example, he says that a step without a non-slip surface is a structural defect. We submit that there's very little difference between a step with a non-slip surface that's therefore dangerous and a step such as the one in our case, which had a nosing on there that wasn't put on right and was dangerous and caused this accident. It would seem to me to not make sense that you would have to say that this has to be as a result of the original construction. For example, assume that the non-slip surface, if someone failed to put on a non-slip surface they're supposed to do at the time of the original construction. According to Boyle, that's a structural defect. Assume that there was a repair made to that building 5 years after the original construction and whoever was repairing it failed to put on a step with a non-slip surface, which would violate some safety code. Would you then say at that point now it's not a structural defect simply because it was done at some later time than the original construction?
Mr. Tarnoff, what is your definition of a structural defect? How would you define it, sir?
I would define a structural defect as a defect that affects the structural integrity of a building on some kind of a permanent or near permanent basis, which is, I believe, what we had and what existed in this case. Applying that example to this case, assume that Bergmeier, the independent contractor that put on these nosings, at the time of the original construction instead of when they did several years later. According to the reasoning of Ameritech and the Court of Appeals, since they chose the wrong materials, they didn't put on the right adhesive, they didn't put it on right, according to them, it would be a structural defect. But then the corollary to that, according to them, is that if the failure to put on the correct adhesives and failure to put this nosing on several years later, the same conduct by Bergmeier does not result in a structural defect. It seems to me that that doesn't make sense.
One would not ordinarily think of a rug as a structural defect, would they? I mean, this is a stairway, and looking at Boyle and his definition, just lead me through how you arrive at...
Well, yeah, you're right. I agree with that. A rug was just...
Well, a rug going up a stairwell would not be a...
Okay, I don't think that's part, an integral part of the structure. When you're talking about nosings that were put on here on a permanent basis...
Well, no permanent would be from X number of years to lasting for 20, as I recall the facts.
Well, okay, there was testimony that these nosings were intended to last up to 20 years of normal traffic. So they're not just making some simple repair, they're reconstructing, Bergmeier reconstructed three stairways in this building and put nosings on every single one of those steps on three different stairways.
When you say reconstruct, the stairway existed, but it was the covering of the stairway that was reconstructed, right?
Well, yeah, they're placing nosings over carpeting that existed on the stairway.
And that was carpeting structure.
I don't think that carpeting is part of this. I don't think that carpeting is a structure, think that...
So if carpeting isn't structural, and you repair the carpeting, how do you get the structural?
The reason that the nosing should be considered a structure is that it's being put on there for some kind of on a permanent basis, must be put on safely, must adhere to the safe place statute, which it did not in this case. And if you go through the examples, Boyle lists a number of examples of structural defects. Those defects that he lists are much closer than to our situation than what he lists as a condition associated with the structure.
Mr. Tarnoff, when the carpeting is replaced, do the nosings have to be replaced as well?
Not necessarily. Well, in this particular case, probably, because in order to get the carpeting off, you'd have to take the nosings off.
Okay, so the nosing doesn't exist separately from the carpeting. Carpeting, it goes over the top of the carpeting?
In this case, it did. It went over the top of the carpeting.
So when you replace the carpeting, obviously, you'd have to take the nosing off.
In this case, yes, you'd have to take the nosing off.
So you have the structure, and then you have carpeting, which isn't structure on top of it, and then you have the nosings on top of the carpeting. But while the carpeting isn't structure, the nosings are because of the length of time they're put on. Is that?
Yeah, that's. And in addition, when you look at the way that Mr. Boyle defines what the Court of Appeals said this was, a condition associated with the structure. He lists examples of that, saying that these are conditions associated with the structure. Failure to turn on a light, loose stone attached by a prior blast in a quarry, unnecessary accumulation of ice on the floor of a plant, clothing racks placed in a department store aisle, paint applied to a wall. These are not anything like what we had in this case.
Boyle says, in defining conditions associated with structure, that they are conditions are those referred to in the statutory language, repair or maintain. Unsafe conditions, he says, are the failure to repair or maintain. I note that your complaint alleges a failure to maintain. I also note that the special verdict, which you joined in, asked the jury a question about failure to maintain. That's the way that the question was phrased for the jury. I also note that you did not want any notice instruction going to the jury. How do you reconcile all these, that you pled it as a failure to maintain, which Boyle says is a condition associated with structure, that it was submitted to the jury on a special verdict with that same language, and yet you're arguing something else? How can you reconcile that?
Okay, the pleading, as the court knows, when you plead, you don't have any of the facts yet. There's been no discovery. There's been no information as to exactly what happened here. As we got into the evidence, and the evidence showed, number one, that these nosings were supposed to be there on a permanent or near-permanent basis, as brought out by Ameritech's counsel in questioning Bergmeier's representative. He asked them, is this supposed to be a permanent change to the stairway? And he answered that in the affirmative.
Counsel, let me focus, and fair enough in the response that, you know, it's notice pleading. And I say, you're right, it's notice pleading. But the special verdict isn't notice pleading, and the special verdict frames the question as, was the defendant negligent in failing to maintain the stairway in question in as safe a manner as the nature of the premises reasonably permitted? And that's the special verdict you requested.
That's right, but I don't think it makes any difference whether you use the word maintain in a question on a special verdict when the proof has been that the defect is structural. Whatever words are used in the special verdict, I don't think is all that important. The question is, what is the proof shown? And, for example, Boyle says that structural defects exist when it's the result of the failure to use the right material or the right layout in construction. That's exactly what happened in this case. That was a Meritex position throughout the case, that the reason that this nosing failed was that it was put on with the wrong kind of adhesive, was put on with the wrong choice of adhesive, or put on with too much adhesive, or some manner of putting these nosings on the stairway was done without the correct materials or application, which would fit into his definition of a structural defect. And he says that any violation of a, Boyle says, generally any violation of an industrial commissioning building code would amount to a structural defect. Here you got a nosing coming off of a stairway only 16 months after they were put onto the stairway. The Krauss case in 9 West 2nd says that the safe place statute is no different than any other statute. And if it's violated, if it's no different than any other safety statute, and even to compare it to the rules of the road in the Krauss case, they say this would then amount to a structural defect. We felt that the Court of Appeals was too distracted by the labels used by Ameritech. They're talking about maintaining and repairing. It's not so much what you label, but it's what the end result of the endeavor is.
Okay, but if this was a repair or a maintenance, don't you have a problem about notice?
Well, no, if it's a structural defect, then we don't have to prove notice.
I know. But if we say, as the Court of Appeals said, it is not a structural defect, do you have a notice problem?
If it's not a structural defect, we have a notice problem. Well, as we explained in our brief, going into the trial, we don't know how the trial court's going to rule, whether the trial court's going to rule in our favor or not on the structural defect issue. It turned out the court did agree with our position. However, we put in very substantial amount of evidence on constructive notice. The failure of Ameritech to have an inspection policy, the fact that two other nosings, when they finally inspected this stairway, finally, after all these months, they found two other nosings on the same stairway that came loose right after the accident happened. And there were many other things that were alluded to in our brief that would consist of constructive notice. So we put in a lot of evidence on constructive notice.
Counsel, I remember those two things that you just referenced. I don't remember the many other things. What are the many other things that suggest
many other
constructive
things.
Notice?
They knew that they had a problem. Early on, they had a problem because there was a discrepancy between the nosing and the carpeting. They weren't flush, and they were supposed to be even, but they weren't.
You're not alleged, just for clarification, you're not alleging, are you, that the accident was caused by the 1/8-inch rise?
No, we're not alleging that. However, Meritech had knowledge of this little discrepancy long before the accident happened. They had knowledge that women were catching their heels walking down the stairs. Even one woman fell, although she didn't get injured. You would think that they never contacted Bergmeier after getting this knowledge. They never instituted an inspection policy. They have testimony that they last inspected the stairway 4 months before the accident. Supposedly they had people on the stairway almost every day doing some kind of maintenance activity. There was testimony by Mr. Rupert from Bergmeier that the stairway should be inspected on a monthly basis. There was testimony by our expert that you would think that the maintenance people would have noticed this, especially when two others come loose right after, when it's finally inspected right after the accident. We believe that there was very substantial evidence of constructive notice, which was alluded to and agreed to by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals in their decision says, yeah, we don't agree that there was constructive notice as a matter of law, like the plaintiff says. We don't agree that there was no constructive notice, as the defendant claims. It should be a jury question, and which leads to the next thing that they should have given us. If this court should agree that this is not a structural defect, we feel we should be given a new trial, because certainly our theory of the case was not frivolous. The trial court agreed that we had a structural defect. One would think that the corollary to the Court of Appeals finding that this was not a structural defect, but there was evidence of constructive notice, that we would get a new trial on the issue of constructive notice. They also state this.
If I may just focus on that, because that is an area of concern to me anyway. Let's assume the Court of Appeals is correct, that this is an unsafe condition as opposed to a structural condition. The Court of Appeals says, it goes on to say, that you didn't seek a new trial as relief when you appealed, and therefore, or you didn't seek it even in the alternative, realizing there was a cross appeal too. And this issue, as I understand it, is an issue that was appealed by opposing counsel, and then you responded cross appeal. That is the issue that was taken by the Court of Appeals. How do you respond to the Court of Appeals' conclusion that you did not seek a new trial, even in the alternative, and therefore we're not going to give you one?
Oh, okay. In the trial court, in motions after verdict, we didn't ask the court for a new trial because it would seem incongruous to ask a court, say, judge, if you reversed an appeal on the structural defect issue, we want a new trial which would include a notice instruction. It just wouldn't seem that you'd do that in the trial court. We thought it was implicit in our position. We're arguing that there was constructive notice as a matter of law. Defense is arguing the contrary. If the Court of Appeals would think that neither side was right, there was evidence that the jury could decide either way, it would be implicit in their reasoning that they would then give us a new trial, which would then include a notice of instruction. As we said, though, if the court thinks we're derelict in not asking for a new trial, we refer the court to 750-106, which I think would, in the interest of justice and a probable miscarriage of justice here, if we didn't get a chance to have another trial and include the notice issue, if this court does not agree that this defect was a structural defect.
What about a new trial just on the notice issue?
Yeah, it would be a new trial just on the notice issue. Put in the proof and let the jury decide based on, we'd have to be able to convince them that Ameritech had constructive notice of this defect.
And that's what you're suggesting, a new trial limited only to that issue, not
only to that issue, right.
If we should give you a new trial only on that issue, don't we still then have to reach the constitutional issue of retroactivity, as well as the imputing of the negligence of
Bergottenmeier to Ameritech?
We'd have to reach that issue as well, and of course you have to also reach the non-delegable duty issue, which is perhaps time to get into that. This court in the Dykstra case.
Counsel, yeah. I just want to clarify that. I read your brief as you wanting, if the court would decide that this was an unsafe condition, that you want a no trial on the issue of liability. That's
right.
What you
right.
Prayed for, as we say. Probably literally and figuratively. But now you've responded to Justice Sykes a little bit differently. She asked whether or not you want a new trial on the issue of notice, and you've
your brief doesn't ask for that. Your brief asks for a new trial on the issue of liability.
Okay,
which
maybe,
is it?
Perhaps it's a matter of semantics. Sure, it'd be a new trial on the issue of liability, which would then include an instruction on notice. We would put in the evidence about constructive notice. They would put in their evidence, so it's...
If it's a new trial on liability, the reason I ask that is the follow-up of Justice Babbage's question. If it is a new trial on liability, then there would be a new assessment of negligence. Right now it's 10-45-45. Who knows what the new trial would bring? And if the new trial brings a very much different distribution of negligence, there may be no issues with regard to retroactive application of 895.
True, that's true. That may well be true, depending how the negligent apportionment would come out in a new trial. On the issue of non-delegability, I want to get to that because I see I don't have too much time left, but we think the law is quite clear. This court in the Dykstra case, which Ameritech says is not very important and tries to play down, this court in 100 was second when it got to the Supreme Court. The court took about two or three pages to describe what is meant by a non-delegable duty. We submit that they had a non-delegable duty here and that Bergmeier's negligence, no matter what else this court decides, what else you decide, that the negligence of Bergmeier should be imputed to Ameritech pursuant to the Dykstra case and pursuant to the cases we cited, the New Hampshire, the Iowa case, the restatement of torts. I mean, the law is, we think, is quite clear in what Dykstra said. Ameritech says, makes two arguments. They say that we didn't delegate this duty to Bergmeier. Certainly they did delegate the duty. If by that they mean we didn't say, we hereby delegate our safe place duty to you, of course not. But they hired Bergmeier as an independent contractor to change the stairway, and they were therefore delegating their safe place duty to Bergmeier. Then they say that, well, we're not trying to substitute Bergmeier as the primary defendant here. I think the example that I gave, I don't think that Ameritech can answer this example. And I said, assume that everybody was sued within 3 years, assume Bergmeier was found 90% causally negligent, Ameritech is found not negligent, assume Bergmeier is uncollectible, the 90% of negligence should be imputed to Ameritech. And I think Ameritech would say, no, it shouldn't be imputed to them. They're not, and if that's the position they take, then they are substituting Bergmeier as the primary defendant in this case, despite a non-delegable duty, contrary to what is asserted in the Dykstra case. And they cite one of the cases that they rely on, the Brooks case. They say, well, you can have certain non-delegable duties if it's based on a contract or extra hazardous activity. But one of the things that Brooks also said was that it can be by statute. You can have a non-delegable duty by statute, which is what we have here. Clearly, under the Safe Place statute, you got a non-delegable duty. Brooks was cited with approbation in the Estate of Thompson case in 225 was second, where they said you can have it by statute. You can have a non-delegable duty. And that the premise behind that is that there's certain duties that are too important to be able to bargain away, which included the duty that lies on the owner of a place of employment under the Safe Place statute.
Counsel, you've argued both non-delegable duty and unconstitutionality at 895, etc. It seems to me you only need to win on one. Are those argued in the alternative? In other words, if it's unconstitutional, then arguably you would get be able to recover all of the amounts against both
third-party defendant and defendant, or in the alternative, if it's a non-delegable duty, you could recover all 90%.
Well, not necessarily. You could conjure up some fact situations where, you know, I would doubt that Mr. Berry, who's simply walking down the stair and falls and some nosing comes loose, I don't think he should ever have been in the verdict, but that we're not going to have time to get into that. But our position is that if the plaintiff, if a plaintiff is 40% at fault in this case, for example, Ameritech is 30%, Bergmeier is 30%. The negligence of, under the old law, we would lose under any circumstance. The negligence of Bergmeier should be imputed to Ameritech, so that 60% on Ameritech pursuant to the Dykstra case. And
under the old law, though, as long as you, Berry, is less negligent than the other two, you can recover against either one of them. And that's why you're saying it's unconstitutional to retroactively apply it to require them to be more than 50% in order to get joint and several, right?
That's right. And I should add that this is not too, the way that things work in the commercial, in the modern commercial world, this is not a harsh thing for an owner of a place of employment to deal with. When they hire an independent contractor, they can insist on liability insurance. They've got contribution rights, as they had in this case, and they'd have a judgment against Bergmeier, who was insured in this case. They can have indemnity contracts. They have many ways to protect themselves under a non-delegable duty theory.
Thank you, Mr. Tarnoff. Mr. Mullaney.
Good morning, Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is Peter Mullaney. I represent Ameritech in this case. Can you hear me over this?
Yeah,
you can't see me. Can you hear me?
We do both. It's good seeing you again, Mr. Mullaney.
Thank you, Chief Justice. This court, I believe, only needs to consider two issues in this case. The first one is whether the condition of the nosings on Ameritech's building was a structural defect or a condition associated with the structure. The second issue is whether Ameritech had actual or constructive notice of the defect. The answer to question number one, was it structural or was it merely a condition associated with the structure, is that it was a condition associated with the structure. Therefore, that is a non-structural defect, and therefore plaintiff, Mr. Berry, had the burden to prove that Ameritech had notice of the defect. Now, why wasn't this a structural defect? Our view is that it's because the nosings were not unsafe from the moment they were applied. That's what it really comes down to. Our position is that the structural defect exists from day one, that is, from the moment the thing is applied or constructed, there is an unsafe condition on the premises. And it may be because the construction is in violation of some statute or safety regulation or building code, but that unsafe condition exists from the moment it is put in place. Structural defects do not develop over time. Those are maintenance issues. Either the thing is, if it's structural, it's either unsafe at the moment it's created or it's not. If it's not unsafe at the moment it's created, it's not structural. It's a maintenance issue. It's a condition associated with the structure, and notice is required. In this case, the nosings, when they were applied in about 16 months prior to Mr. Berry's fall, they were safe. There is no evidence in this case that those nosings, as applied that day, 16 months before this fall, were unsafe, that anybody tripped on them, that there were accidents. In fact, the evidence is that Mr. Berry himself was on this premise 4 months before he fell, so about a year after the nosings were put in place, and he was going up and down the stairs for the very purpose of inspecting these stairs to see what could be done about this very minor discrepancy between the nosing and the carpet, one eighth of an inch, about two quarters put together, that very minor discrepancy. He was hired to look at the stairs, to look at them, There is no evidence that, and presumably he inspected everything. There's no evidence anywhere from him or anybody else that these stairs, this nosing, was unsafe until the day he fell. The evidence is that the adhesive for the nosings failed unexpectedly. Eventually, that adhesive, according to the evidence, was going to fail. It was intended to be a permanent reconstruction, as the evidence states, but permanence is a relevant, relative term. The evidence is that they were intended to, the adhesive was intended to last from 3 to 20 years. Nothing lasts forever, and that's why it's a maintenance issue. So the fact is that they came undone a little early, and all that means is that Ameritech had a duty to maintain their premises, but they had a right to notice before they could be found liable under the statute.
On your definition of structural defect, you said if it's unsafe in the moment it is constructed, or what? Are you saying that from the construction of the building, or what if these stairs were put in 10 years after the building was initially constructed?
Doesn't make a difference. I don't think that there
is...
It
always then be, unless it's... Are you saying that... I don't understand what you mean when you say it doesn't make a difference. Building constructed in 1950, stairs put in 1960. Can those stairs ever be a structural defect?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So it doesn't matter.
If when they're added to the building subsequently, they are unsafe. If they're in violation when they're constructed of some safety code or regulation, then they're, or if they are, the stairway is put in some inappropriate place, like the cases say. Sometimes there's a stair in place where reasonable people would not expect it to be. If you put a stair 2 feet out of the exit from an elevator, and that's a reconstruction, that is a structural defect, even though it may be added on. For example, we have ADA requirements. Lots of old buildings are reconstructed these days to comply with ADA, I think. If the ADA requires a building owner or an employer to put a ramp in the building to comply with ADA, and at the end of that ramp there is a 2-inch elevation drop between the floor and the ramp, from the moment that is constructed, even though it's added on after the fact, from the moment that's constructed, that's unsafe. And the building owner knows it. It's not a matter of deterioration over time. It doesn't matter that it's a reconstruction or modification. The point is, it's unsafe when it's put on there. And the owner knows it, and that's why he doesn't need notice.
That's an easy example because you're pointing to a violation of a safety code in terms of structures. Let's take a little harder example. What if steps are put on subsequent to the remodel, subsequent to the original construction of the room or the building, and the steps are tiled steps, and they're a bit slippery? Is that a structural defect?
It depends. If those tiled stairs are in violation of some code.
That's why I asked. Okay. That's why I said you were only giving examples of if it's a violation of a code, and that's easy. So you're telling me, I'm saying, that if you build steps and you put tile in on the steps, and those steps are built as a remodeling project, that's not a structural defect. Is that what you're saying?
If those steps are unsafe from the moment they are created because of the nature of the step.
Because the slipperiness of the tile. I'm not talking about a violation of a code.
Okay.
I'm talking about slippery tile. Is that a structural defect, or is that an unsafe condition?
I think it depends. I think if there's evidence in the case, say the plaintiff brings in a structural engineer and says, this is not in violation of any code or statute, but this tile in this location is clearly unsafe. It's inappropriate. Anybody walking in this building is going to slip on this. Then perhaps that's a structural defect.
That's a problem to me, because as you look at Boyle's cases, they don't depend on how does an expert witness clarify this. I mean, that's a whole new phenomenon, saying only an expert witness can tell us. I mean, we're supposed to be able to know. So let's take those same steps. Is there any question if it was part of the original construction that you would consider that a structural defect?
Well, I guess, Justice, I'm having trouble with the theory of the case. I mean, if the theory in your case is that this tile was unsafe from day one, then yes, I think it's a structural defect.
Okay.
It has to do with the a defect in construction material or improper layout and construction.
Okay, that's as the original. 10 years later, stairs are added onto. Now your answer is the same as a structural defect if it was too slippery from day one?
It can be, if that's the theory, yes.
Okay. Then I want to say that they were fine 10 years when the remodeling was done and they were installed, but after 2 years of wear, the resistance sand that was in that began to wear away, and then they became slippery. Is that a structural defect?
Well, I'm having trouble with the theory.
I'll tell you where I'm going. Okay. As I read the Court of Appeals opinion, they adopt your argument that I have never seen before in safe place law. And that maybe because I haven't seen enough of safe place law, by the way. So, but safe place law, as I know it, primarily deals with the structure or the unsafe condition. And it ties into the language of the statute. If you're talking about structure, you're talking about condition. If you're talking about structure, you're talking about construction. If you're talking about unsafe condition, you're using and employing the words of the statute that deal with failure to maintain or repair. That's right out of Boyle, that's right out of lots of cases. Now the Court of Appeals comes with a brand new word, modification. And I just don't know that word and that analysis in safe place terminology. That's where I'm going. And it seems to me that it's modification is pretty imprecise. Justice Babbage picked it up right away with his initial question. What about if it was remodeled? And is that original? What do you mean from original? What do you mean from modification? That's where I'm going.
Okay, and I appreciate that that's a significant issue in this case. One of the problems we have with Boyle is that this is a rather old treatise and doesn't deal with those modification issues very effectively. Neither does the case law. I don't think the Court of Appeals had any choice but to talk about modification to the original structure, because that's what happened here. Our position, let me put it this way. Are we saying that any modifications to original construction can never be structural? No. I agree with the Court of Appeals in footnote 8, where they say that one can contemplate a permanent reconstruction that produces a structural defect. And this goes back to my ADA example, a permanent reconstruction of a building to comply with ADA may require a ramp, and that ramp may be defective or unsafe as it's installed. That's a modification, I think, and the kind of modifications that we're talking about. And I think that for purposes of this case and for purposes of establishing some precedent in this state for what is a structural defect, what we are proposing is that the court hold that a structural defect is a defect in construction material or a defect in layout or construction, and where there is an unsafe, or those things are unsafe from the moment they are constructed, whether it's a reconstruction, a modification, or something else. I think the key point is that they are unsafe from the moment they are constructed. And the reason that's important is it distinguishes those structural defect cases from the maintenance and failure to repair cases. Because in maintenance and failure to repair cases, which is what this is, the defect occurs over time. It develops through a failure of, in this case, adhesive, through use, through whatever. I mean, things do fall into disrepair. That's what happened in this case. Like I said at the beginning, there is no evidence that this stairway was unsafe as constructed with the nosings. That it was in use for 16 months. People were up and down that stairway. No problems. Mr. Berry fell, and it turns out that the adhesive failed prematurely. Our view, and even on the special verdict in this case, the question that was asked was, did Ameritech fail to maintain their building in a manner as safe as the premises allowed? That was the verdict question. That was the plaintiff's theory, that we did not maintain our building by inspecting these nosings and making sure that they didn't deteriorate. That's a maintenance problem. That's why we needed notice. We were not in position to expect any problem with those steps when Bergmeier walked out of our building the day he finished putting the nosings on. They were not unsafe that day, not in violation of any code.
Mr. Mullaney, let's assume that we accept your position that this is an unsafe condition associated with the structure. Why shouldn't we order a new trial here? Because the notice issue was never really presented to the jury.
Two reasons, Judge, and Justice Crooks. One, I think that Mr. Berry had an opportunity the first time around to present his notice evidence, and he did so. I think it's clear that he says in his briefs that we expected that this might be an issue, so we put our best case forward. We presented everything we had on the notice issue. And then they took the position that no notice is not required, and because it was a structural defect. Now there's a reversal. Now Ameritech is in a position of having to retry the case again because the court ultimately rejected the theory that they had. And we tried it on a wrong theory because this is what the theory they wanted to pursue. So I guess there's some unfairness in that in our view. But more importantly, I think, is that this court is in position on this de novo review to look at the transcript and the evidence of notice and assume if a notice instruction was given, as it should have been, could a reasonable jury have, well, no, was there any credible evidence to support a finding that Ameritech had notice of this condition? Our position is that you can look at this record closely and find no such notice. There is no evidence of actual notice that Ameritech knew that the nosings were loose before the accident. I think that's undisputed. The only issue is constructive notice. Did Ameritech have constructive notice? The key there is that, and I don't think that this is addressed in any depth in Barry's brief, but the key there is that the law is well established that the plaintiff must have evidence of the length of time the defect existed before the accident occurred. In fact, that is in the safe place instruction. If this case had gone to the jury on the proper theory that Ameritech had to have notice, the jury would have been instructed with Wisconsin Civil 1900.4. That states in part that the jury must find that the defendant had actual notice or that the defect existed for such a length of time before the accident that Ameritech or its employees in the exercise of reasonable diligence should have discovered it. That's right in the instruction. The jury would have been given that. Is there any credible evidence in this record that Ameritech had notice that the defect existed for any length of time before this incident?
That
that presupposes the jury was properly instructed. I have problems with this because I don't know whether to look at it as a sufficiency of the evidence as you're advancing, or to say, look, what we're trying to decide is if we can uphold the integrity of this verdict. And if the jury was never told that notice is a necessary element to prove, then how can we in any way infer that the jury made a finding that adequate notice was demonstrated? How can we embrace the integrity of the verdict when a necessary element that the jury has to find is notice, and they were never instructed that they have to find notice?
I think because we know that Mr. Berry put his best case forward. He gave us all his evidence, and I think this court and appellate courts generally look at the evidence and determine, is there enough credible evidence here for a reasonable jury to find for the claimant? And I think that's all we have to do in this case.
Well, that's the disconnect. I mean, maybe there could have been a lot of notice or a little notice evidence, but how do you get that, whether there's a little or a lot, to equal that the jury knew that an element of the offense or the element of the cause of action is notice, and that in order for them to find an unsafe condition, they had to make a finding that there was actual constructive notice? How do you make that connection?
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that all we can do is, if we assume that they... Let me put it this way. If we retry this case, we go back a second time, and we give this notice instruction, we know from what Mr. Berry has told us that he's already put out all of his best evidence. And absent from that evidence is this one crucial piece of information, and that is, how long did the defect exist before the accident? I think we can presume, because we've tried the case, that he doesn't have that evidence. So why should a second... As a matter of law, a jury can't find against Ameritech because that's missing. I think the case will be back up here again, and you'll be looking at this record and asking, where's the credible evidence of the length of time that the defect existed? Now, as I said at the outset, there are only two issues that this court needs to address in our view. I do believe that this was a defect associated with the structure, therefore there was a notice requirement. I do believe that on this record this court can decide that there was no notice, and therefore this case is over. Those are the only two issues. If I'm wrong, and this court concludes, as did the trial judge, that there was a structural defect and no notice was required, then I think the court has to address one or both of the other arguments, the imputation, the non-delegability imputation argument, or the constitutionality of the statute. In the alternative, if the court concludes that a new trial is necessary, I think we also have to reach one or both of those issues. I'll deal with the non-delegability issue first, for the imputation argument. From what Mr. Tarnoff mentioned, it sounds like that is the one that would probably be dispositive if it's decided in his favor. We probably don't have to reach the other one. Why should we not impute Bergmeier's negligence to Ameritech in this case? There are a number of reasons. Number one, we don't have to reach it. I've already discussed that. Number two, the general rule in Wisconsin for years has been that the negligence of an independent contractor is not imputed to an owner or general contractor, absent exceptional circumstances defined under Wisconsin law as an imminent danger or I believe it's a high-risk danger kind of activity, or a special relationship, where there's a special relationship between the plaintiff and the owner-contractor. For example, landlord-tenant situation. That neither of those situations exist here. Mr. Tarnoff isn't arguing that, as I understand it. But that is the general rule. I believe the general rule is you don't impute. Another reason. There are no Wisconsin cases that I have found or that Mr. Tarnoff has cited in his brief in the 90 years that the Safe Place statute has been the law in this state. No Wisconsin cases that hold that the negligence of an independent contractor must be imputed to the owner, that is an owner that is liable under the Safe Place statute. The Dykstra case is cited for the proposition that's true, that for the proposition, I guess, that Dykstra holds that, but it doesn't. The facts in Dykstra were quite different. It dealt with the enforceability of an indemnity contract between a subcontractor and a general contractor. It didn't have anything to do with imputation. I think that Mr. Berry, in this case, is confusing delegability, the non-delegability of Safe Place duties, with imputation of negligence. Those are two different concepts, and the imputation part of that, the imputation concept, is not dealt with in Wisconsin cases. So I think there's a hole in the case law in that regard. there
doesn't,
is case
doesn't
law.
Doesn't non-delegability mean that it's in effect imputed?
I don't think so.
Okay, why not? I
Chief
always
Justice.
Thought that if it's non-delegable, it means whoever did it for you, it's as if you had done it, and that's it.
I don't think that's the way the case law, the Safe Place statute, should be interpreted. There is, in the Dykstra case, a statement that the court made explaining what non-delegability means in the context of the Safe Place statute. And that's cited at page 22 of our brief. And basically they say that all that is meant by that statement, that duties under the Safe Place statute are non-delegable, is that the person who has the duty cannot assert that another to whom he has allegedly delegated it is substituted as the primary defendant. Now what does that mean? Let me give you an example to explain what I think that means. Take a situation where a business on State Street, say a coffee shop, the owner of that coffee shop hires a contractor, an electrician, to hang a light in the store. He wants to hang lights somewhat like these in this room, but lower over each of the tables. So one evening, after all the customers are gone from the premises, the electrician comes into the store, hangs the lights. Unfortunately, he does so in a way where they're too low and they're in the traffic pattern, not over the tables. And this is in violation of a building code. The next morning, the owner comes to open up his store at 6:30 a.m. and with him is a customer right there at the door. He opens the door, the owner walks in, the customer hits his head on one of the lights that are too low. I believe under the Safe Place statute, what that means is that the owner cannot say, I had no notice of this problem, I just walked in my store. In fact, I told my contractor to put these lights over the tables and higher. You know, he blew this, it's not my fault, you sue the contractor. What the Safe Place statute, and there may be no practical evidence of negligence on the part of the store owner. What the Safe Place statute does, I think, is it says the owner cannot say, it's his fault. The owner's on the verdict. Why? Because the Safe Place statute says he's an owner of the premises, and he has an obligation to keep his premises as safe as the nature of the premises would reasonably permit. It's a higher duty. It's a different duty.
Is he liable?
Is he liable?
The owner liable?
It depends on what the jury says.
Well, but on what basis can anybody, as a matter of law, find him liable when he gave the independent contractor the right instructions, told him how to do it, and all of that was perfectly, let us assume, non-negligent. So he didn't have, he was not negligent at all. So he's on, he may be a defendant. How can you find him liable? You cannot find him liable unless you say he is responsible for that independent contractor, regardless of it, of his own freedom from negligence.
Well, I believe that if I were representing that store owner, I would make that as my closing argument. But I think he's on the verdict, and I think that a jury could find him negligent under the safe play statute.
Negligent.
Find the owner negligent.
Not the way we set up these facts. You'd have to have a directed verdict for that employer unless you said all of the negligence of the electrician is imputed to him because it's non-delegable. I don't understand the difference between non-delegable and imputed.
I believe that this issue is one of first impression in the state, first of all, this imputation argument. And I don't think that we can say that the legislature intended for the Safe Place statute to impute the negligence of a contractor to an owner.
Do we agree it's non-delegable under the Safe Place statute?
I agree. The duties, but what does non-delegable mean? And that's what we're debating. At any rate, if the court needs to reach that issue, our view is that the negligence of Bergmeier, the contractor, should not be imputed to Ameritech under the Safe Place statute because that's not the law in Wisconsin. That's not what any case law says in Wisconsin. And I don't believe that's what non-delegable means under the case law. Now, will it help an injured party to have more than one pocket to recover from? Yes, but that's what Wobble has argued in this case, but that's not the decisive factor. The question is that what it means for a Safe Place duty to be non-delegable? I don't think it does. The other issue, the constitutionality issue, as I said, I don't think you have to reach that if you deal with the imputation issue. But if you reach the imputation issue and you say that it's that there is no obligation or there is no imputation from the contractor to Ameritech, then I would just rest on our briefs on the constitutionality issue. And the key there, I think, is that the change in the comparative negligence statute occurred 2.5 years after Mr. Barry's accident here. And he had ample opportunity to file his claim before the statute changed. He had notice, his attorneys had notice of the change in the law. He could have, but didn't, take advantage of the old statute. Moreover, he could have sued Bergmeier, but he didn't do that either. My red light is on. If there are no further questions, I'll sit.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Tarnoff, you have 5 minutes to rebuttal.
Mr. Mullaney began his argument by stating that the placing of the nosings on these three stairways was intended to be a permanent reconstruction. Footnote on page 9, a footnote of the Court of Appeals, they say Barry argues that adding nosings to each step is essentially a permanent reconstruction, since the nosings were intended to become a permanent part of the stairway. Then they say this, that they say, although Barry's implicit theory is intriguing, they were intrigued, if not persuaded, it simply does not encompass the facts of this case, but it does encompass the facts of this case. It's exactly what the defendants have said, that this was a permanent reconstruction, and they're questioning and cross-examination of Bergmeier's people, they brought that fact out. Now they say, well, a structural defect has to be unsafe from the day that it's first put in place. It's got to be unsafe from the beginning. We submit that these nosings were unsafe from the day that they were put on. Maybe the accident didn't happen for 16 months. It's like the example used in our brief. If a ladder is manufactured and the rungs of the ladder don't comply with standards, they're not strong enough to hold the amount of weight that they're supposed to hold, it doesn't mean that the first person that uses that ladder is going to wind up in an accident.
Also, Meritex theory. Just for the record, is there anything in the evidence that shows that the third-party defendant did anything other than install the nosings?
Bergmeier, no. All they did was they installed the nosings.
So so the jury found them 45% negligent for
right.
installing.
Right, because there was substantial evidence that Meritech put on most of the evidence at the trial in that regard, that they used the wrong adhesive. Their adhesive was either improperly put on the stairway or they used the wrong adhesive to begin with, meaning that stairway was unsafe from the time that they first completed it, even though the accident happened 16 months later. This wasn't like some maintenance situation where you think, well, gee, you put on nosings and then gradually over a long, long period of time, many years, they gradually wore out and somebody got injured. You didn't have that kind of situation. These things, this thing gave way 16 months after it was initially placed on the stairway because it was dangerous from the inception. And then they found two other nosings that were loose on the same stairway. And with regard to the constructive notice issue, Ameritech gives you a very extremely narrow definition of constructive notice. So if they were talking about that you got to prove the exact length of time that some defect existed, it would be almost impossible to prove it. We proved constructive notice by many, many items of proof, including that they had no inspection policy. They knew there was a problem with this stairway because of these nosings. They never contacted Bergmeier, never started an inspection policy, never had their maintenance people report to them if they found anything wrong with the stairway. There was lots of things, as the Court of Appeals acknowledged, that a jury could have considered to be constructive notice. With regard to the non-delegability duty, I submit to you that if you were to accept Meritech's definition of non-delegability under the Safe Place statute, it would render the rule meaningless. The Dykstra case says what it says, and it says that the negligence is imputed. They use master-servant language, but the language is nevertheless is clear. The negligence is imputed to the owner under the Safe Place statute. If you look at the last issue of Black's Law Dictionary, in there we've got non-delegable duty. Black defines non-delegable duty this way: a duty that may be delegated to an independent contractor by a principal who retains primary responsibility if the duty is not properly performed. Using the example that Mr. Mullaney gave about this customer that comes in and hits his head, and then there's a question, the negligence shouldn't be imputed to the owner. That's the kind of thing that the non-delegable duty rule is supposed to avoid. If you had a situation where this independent contractor were uncollectible, then the owner could say, we didn't do anything negligent, and the injured person would have no one to recover from. And this duty under the Safe Place statute is considered too important to bargain away, as stated in the Estate of Thompson case. It cannot be delegated, and that's why there's an imputation of negligence. Again, it's not too harsh a rule because the owner still has contribution rights, can have indemnity contracts, they can insist on having an independent contractor that shows them a certificate of insurance, such as in this case. In this case, it's kind of ironic. Bergmeier isn't here to argue, but if the imputation of negligence from Bergmeier to Ameritech is made, Bergmeier's going to wind up paying because they were at trial and they had insurance and so forth. It wouldn't really cost Ameritech anything if the negligence of Bergmeier is imputed to them. And that's the whole purpose of the non-delegability rule. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tarnoff. That concludes our hearing in this second case of the day, 98-25.